Welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast, the podcast that pulls back the curtain on the evolving world of sports science. I'm Andrew Rizza, an athlete trainer with decades of experience in professional, collegiate, and high school sports.
And I'm Cameron Roth, an orthopedic surgeon and a consultant for the Chicago White Sox.
In each episode, we'll explore the real-world challenges and opportunities facing today's human performance professionals.
Our hands-on experience is transforming sports medicine and breaking barriers through innovation and teamwork.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. This week, I have John Lopez. John has been an athletic trainer since 1970, a few years before I was born, and has had numerous positions, professional football with Tampa Bay Buccaneers, with the Baltimore and Indianapolis Colts, private practice sports medicine, sales job with Collins Sports Medicine, dear friend of mine, Wally Collins, for some years, and then has continued to do some work in the sports medicine and athletic training profession, also educator and since retired. So I figured John would be a great person to speak to about the state of our profession of athletic training and discuss some of the stuff maybe happening within the organization, the NATA, and where it is. And I think it'll be a great conversation. John, thanks for taking the time today. I appreciate it. Welcome to the show.
Great. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Can you give the listeners a little bit more background about yourself, your journey as an athletic trainer?
Well, I started off as a freshman in college at the University of Florida as an electrical engineer major. I proceeded to have a year and a half of the greatest weekend of my life. Needless to say, my grade point average was in the you-know-what. But eventually, I came to my senses and straightened myself out and actually really wanted to be a physical education teacher and a coach. That's really all I wanted to do. So got my first job while I was still as an undergrad in Tampa, working at a private high school. My old high school coach was working at Tampa Catholic High School. And so he hired me as an offensive line coach for the JV team and the assistant track and field coach. And I was also the part-time equipment manager and the athletic trainer because I had taken a Kramer First Aider course, and I knew how to tape ankles. So My first job was about $250 for the first semester. And my mom said, you know, you better start doing your own laundry because now you're making a lot of money.
Yeah, that's right.
Anyway, long story short, that developed into an opportunity to move to the University of Tampa. Again, as an undergrad, they didn't have a curriculum program. There were only two or three curriculum programs in the country at that time. In the late 60s, you kind of had to learn a lot and rely on mentorship. And I had two good mentors, actually three good mentors. My old high school coach, Tony Janitis, who was at that time moving over to the University of South Florida. Brady Greathouse, who was at the University of Florida in Gainesville. And Don Falls, who was at Florida State University in Tallahassee. You got to remember, at that time, you know, and there was only three collegiate athletic trainers in the entire state of Maryland. Dave Weick was the other athletic trainer down at the University of Miami. And there were no high school athletic trainers. My high school coach was a physical education teacher and a coach. And so, you know, in the late 60s, we didn't have certification. We didn't have formal education programs. There were only a couple, you know, Purdue, Indiana State, Arizona. There were not curriculum programs like you have all over the place. Mm-hmm. My opportunity started off as a coach and kind of transformed into athletic training. As I got into it more, it became more and more interesting. I learned more and more. I relied on more and more mentorship from those guys and eventually was able to take the first certification exam, which was in 1971. So it's been a long time. If I had it to do over again, I'm not sure if I would do it that same way again. But during those periods of times, we didn't have the educational opportunity. So a lot of it, you relied on buying your own books, asking a lot of questions, going to as many meetings as you possibly could, and learning just from the grandfathers of the profession.
Yeah, and you know, you brought up the Kramer Clinics, and I was talking to Chris Trianos a couple episodes back about sports medicine and the marathon. And Chris was one of my first clinical experiences at Babson College. And he said how he got introduced into athletic training back in, you know, the late 70s, early 80s was the Kramer Clinics. And he said, you know, back then it was the same thing. We didn't realize what we actually had available. And that's how he got interested in the profession. And, you know, as I met more and more athletic trainers when I was coming up in the, you know, late 90s, I met a lot of those mentors to Chris that were kind of towards the end of their career. But it was those are the people that I found that the education was more valuable than me sitting in class, learning in the classroom, you know, listening to them and some of their experiences, how they learned, how they treated the athlete, the way they evaluated, the way they treated. So like you mentioned, mentorship. And I think that was very, very valuable for me. And that's something I try to instill with my students now, is that, you know, ask questions. You know, you're going to learn 70 to 80% of your education and get that knowledge in your clinical experiences.
Very quick story. Greg Foligno, who was the head athletic trainer at Mass Maritime Academy for many years, retired not long ago, was a student at the University of Tampa when I was there. And unbeknownst to me, he wanted to become an athletic trainer, but he was getting financial aid to be our student equipment manager. Mm-hmm. But every time I turned around, he was behind me in the athletic training room, you know, watching what was going on, looking, watching tape and ankles, you know, asking me a question, this and that. And then I didn't find out until after he graduated and went back to Massachusetts that, you know, he really wanted to become an athletic trainer. So he had an old-time member, a mentor as well, Joe DeLore, mm-hmm. who was the longtime athletic trainer for the Celtics. And so, yeah, that's how we did it in those days, you know, because we didn't have formal education. Katie wasn't around. There was no educational council to coordinate everything. You know, yeah. we were trying to figure out things on our own as we were going. You imagine what the guys who were doing it back in the 40s and 50s and 60s, you know, had to
right.
contact, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so I think that's, yeah, it's come a long way. And that's why we're talking today is like, where is the state of our profession, right? There's a lot of discussion about it, you know, cost of education being one thing versus rate of return and salaries. And, you know, I think a lot of us are at fault for the salaries too, as well as our organization. We can get into that a little bit more. And, you know, it is interesting that we don't want to see a profession, you know, all of a sudden, you know, disappear and die. We put so much money into it and so much heart and soul into what we do. So at the NATA, you know, this past December, it said there was 34,000 members in the organization, including 2,000 new members. And then 500 of those are international members. Now, the NATA continues to support the growth and development of the profession, but there's 2,400 retired or certified retired members, and a small number of those are completely retired or just retired members that are grandfathered in. So given the current statistics, do you feel like the organization needs to address the retention and engagement of the profession to control or continue the growth and development of the organization? Or do you feel like it's outside of the hands of them and more along the lines of the educational institutions to do that and to the mentors and the people that are in the profession?
Well, you know, we have a strategic alliance that is an alliance between the NATA, Katie, and the VOC. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, my personal feeling is I don't feel that the strategic alliance is very strategic right now, mm-hmm. because, you know, we're educating much better. We're producing graduates at the master's level. We've got over 60,000 certified athletic trainers, according to the BOC's numbers. Mm-hmm. Yet we're down in the low 20s in the NATA membership. So, something's not working right now. And I think that they need to go back and analyze. So is education driving those numbers away from the NATA, or is it the BOC, or is it just our economy and where things are going? Mm-hmm. You know, as I get older, things accelerate so much faster. And I think that that's happening not only as a perception, but in reality as well. So if you look at what's happened just since COVID,
yeah,
the use of electronic medical records, the influence now of telehealth and being able to do things remotely, we began to look at that in 2020. When I had, you know, 750 students that were scattered all over the country and all over the world. I had kids in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Germany, Ireland. So they were all over the place. And I really wanted to use remote rehab and conditioning programs. But yet the hospital system that I worked for at that time wasn't capable to move in that direction fast enough. So mm-hmm. things are moving faster than what we can react to. I don't know that membership right now is being driven primarily by the business model and in the institutional model that we developed for the athletic training over the last 75 years. Something has to change. Mm-hmm. Now, does that mean you don't rely on membership drives and everybody's just going to renew just because they want to be a member of the NATA? Does that mean that you change your annual meeting and go away from that as your primary revenue source? Does that mean that you become more involved in CEUs like they're doing right now, so everybody has access to electronic CEU opportunities? There's just a lot of questions out there. You know, some people blame the educators for trying to drive the salary schedule up higher so that our new grads can not take a job at $38,000 a year working 100 hours a week, mm-hmm. but they can start at $75,000 or $80,000 or $90,000 a year. Some people blame the old system, the old collegiate system, the high school system, that they're willing to take those jobs that pay low salaries and work horrendous hours. Mm-hmm. Where is the issue? Where is the problem? I think that's where we have to have an honest discussion. Again, I think the structure of how our association is put together, do we need to have districts? You know, do you need to have District 1, District 2, District 3, et cetera? Are they playing a role? So do people go to district meetings? Well, I know the EATA is a very successful meeting every year. But our meeting here in the Mid-Atlantic area in District 3, the numbers are going down very, very quickly. So I don't know that there's a unique answer to all this, but definitely I think the NATA has to address its issues of membership and finances because we're losing money. We're losing members.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you talk about districts and NATA, EATA, like the district conferences versus the national conference. The hard part for a lot of people that work in secondary schools where there's a larger percentage of athletic trainers that are working these days is that they have vacation times in the summer and on the holidays. And the last thing they probably want to do is to go to a district or a national meeting during their vacation time. So I think it's kind of hard to be able to do that. And I can see your point to being, hey, if the meetings are mainly for educational purposes, is there a way for us to continue doing education digitally? And that's where people get their CEs. Now, we always love going to the meetings because you get to be able to meet new people and be able to see old faces that you haven't seen in a while. And you can collaborate and you get to go to your, you know, your district meetings to talk about stuff within your state or within your district. But I think there's less of that going on because I felt like the educational piece was very redundant year over year. It was the same old thing. It was more of the research, what's going on versus more of the hands-on experiences. But now we're seeing a lot more over the last 10 years or so with the EBPs and what you need to get for your CEs that it was allowing you to go in and maybe get a little bit more variety. So I think there's definitely this paradigm shift, and I don't know the answer to it, but it is quite interesting. I think I'm going this year to the NATA convention, and it's probably the first one I've been to since, I want to say it was Las Vegas the first time around. It was probably over 10 years ago. Because of that strict reason, I work for a secondary school, and we would revolve our vacations for our family around that. And for us, it was, you know, NATA convention in the end of June, like we were either going somewhere or had other things planned. So it was very difficult for us. Now that my daughter's grown up and she's kind of out on her own, I can now, you know, do these things in the latter part of my career to be able to continue to collaborate with peers. So
the cost is another big consideration because, you know, historically, you get your athletic director or your principal or maybe your district superintendent would pay for your expenses to go to the annual meeting. That's not happening anymore,
right?
You know, and for instance, with the large orthopedic hospital system that I work for, they said, we're not paying for your CEUs anymore, but we'll give you MedBridge.
Right.
So we have MedBridge and I can sit in my bedroom, you know, sit here in my pajamas and get all the CEUs that I need by doing it online, not have to get in a plane, incur a lot of expenses, hotel bills, fight with the airport, you know, miss your flight and wait for your flight. All those things are changing the dynamics of our society. Are changing today. And I think really we need to go back and rethink that our annual meeting may not be the thing that's going to continue to carry the association anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. It'll be interesting to see, right? More to come on that. We'll see. Given the current job market trends, you know, athletic training is growing because I think there's more opportunities in the secondary school settings. And I think the collegiate and professional levels are always been there, at least since I've been practicing. But I think the secondary and youth programs, it's growing because there's more education and availability of funds, which sometimes is not a lot, but it's still there. Increased recognition of the importance of sports medicine and injury prevention. And, you know, as schools and organizations prioritize their health and safety, the demand of the skilled athletic trainer is expected to rise and continue to rise. Do you feel that athletic trainers need to be adaptable and consider expanding their expertise into multiple disciplines to remain competitive in the workforce as compared to PT or sports science? You know, is that something that we need to be more disciplined to be diverse? Or do you feel like we can really focus on us being traditional athletic trainers and getting those jobs that pay more, give us the ability to be employed gainfully, and we have opportunities at our fingertips?
Well, yes and no. I'm a traditionalist in many respects. So, yeah, I'd like to see us be able to remain at the secondary school level and the collegiate level. However, I think those models are not going to work for many people today. Mm-hmm. So if you go back to the original intent of what the NATA was to educate us, to prepare us to become better professionals, to grow the profession, to let people know who we were and what we did. We're still struggling in doing that 75 years later. Mm-hmm. We're still trying to let people know who we are and what we can do. I think we failed when we did not embrace the fact that in the late 60s and mid 70s, there were a group of athletic trainers that were moving into the non-traditional settings, i.e. the clinical or industrial or corporate settings. So if you look at that historically, General Motors hired the first certified athletic trainer to reduce their injuries in 1965. Hmm. They realized they paid Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan more money in premiums than what their profits were every year. So they said, this is insanity. We can't keep up with this.
Yeah.
So they started hiring athletic trainers. Then if you look at what was going on at Temple University, you know, when Joe Torg and Ted started the sports medicine concept there in community sports medicine and reaching out to the high schools, all of a sudden everybody was saying, hey, we can have the same services that the University of Pennsylvania, that Penn can have, Temple can have, that Penn State can have. So there was a move towards athletic trainers going into those clinical settings. And then you had the development of the whole corporate mentality. So, you know, Ken Kopke and Ron Sendry at Central Michigan University back in the mid-70s, they created that same program also. And then Ken parlayed that into his company, WorkFit, where they begin to go out and contract with large companies like General Motors, Boeing Aircraft. Those were the things that were moving the profession in a direction that the NATA at that time did not want to recognize. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, there was a concerted effort that if you said you were a non-traditional athletic trainer, i.e., not working in a high school or a collegiate setting, number one, you couldn't call yourself an athletic trainer. Two, you couldn't be a certified athletic trainer mm-hmm. anymore. And three, you couldn't be a member of the NATA. Well, what's happened? So we've got people that are working in clinics like yourself. Mm-hmm. Outreach programs became very successful. You know, the advent of the large major corporations, you know, like HealthSouth, NovaCare, ATI,
yeah.
they began to hire more and more athletic trainers. The athletic training profession began to move in a lot of different directions. Educators were not prepared for it because mm-hmm. they weren't doing as good a job to prepare them to get into a clinical setting or the industrial setting. We didn't know a whole lot about ergonomics. We didn't know anything about documentation. If you were working in a clinical setting, our documentation skills were outrageously horrible, mm-hmm. still not very good today. But there's a lot of transition that has to occur. In order for that to happen, the NATA, our educators, and the BOC have to embrace all that. Now, mm-hmm. we did have an effort at that about 2000. As a matter of fact, when Chad Starkey was the chair of the old education council, he impaneled a task force to look at the idea of certificates of added qualifications. Now, CAQs were essentially specialty certification. So what do we have today? You know, here we are in 2024, moving to 2025. We've got athletic trainers who are now getting their BOC specialty certification in orthopedics.
Right.
That was one of the specialty certifications we recommended to the NATA. The NATA killed that proposal. Mm-hmm. So in many ways, you know, we kind of shoot ourselves in the foot over and over and over again by making the same mistake. So mm-hmm. instead of embracing the move, we lost those members because now they're members of professional societies. So you have the tactical athletic trainers, you have the performing art athletic trainers, you have the clinical athletic. Everybody's kind of doing their own little thing, developing their own societies. And so the NATA continues to bleed its members because number one, they find out that it's costing them a lot of money to remain in the traditional setting. Those salaries are not the only people that are making right now, are the ones that are in professional sports.
Yeah. Yeah.
Major League Baseball, the NFL and the NBA, they're making good money and God bless them. That's great. But if you look at many high school athletic trainers, they're struggling.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. You started talking about General Motors and Boeing. And I remember Chad talking about this because Chad was my program director at Northeastern before I went back to Ohio. And he was talking back then in the mid to late 90s about industrial athletic trainers and working for NASCAR and Disney and all these performing arts. Like, this is where the profession needs to go. And this is what needs to happen to be, you know, not just being strictly in certain settings. But I think, like you said, the NATA didn't want that. And that's where the BOC went and started to do this specification for certification for orthopedics. So it is quite interesting. And I think there's a lot more people that are working in the military now and in municipalities. And I call them industrial athletes. I mean, they need to be functionally ready to go back to work and to be functional, to be productive for that organization. So however you look at it, as long as you're taking care of the active individual, I feel like you're doing your job as an athletic trainer. And to go, you know, into the salary piece with discrepancies, there's a critical issue with the profession. One, salaries are low. Rate of return on investment is one of those things that we talk about quite frequently. I look at it as being, if you're spending $60,000, $70,000 a year for education, you got to look at the entire career time that you're going to work as being your career. So you will make that return back. It may not be as quick if you were a lawyer or a physician, but you will make it back, I think, over time. There's been very significant disparities in the 25th percentile and the 75th percentile of earning. And we know that the continuing advocacy for fair compensation and recognition of the value of the athletic trainer with their employers and communities need to happen. Some high schools have a pretty good set up for their athletic trainers if they're faculty or known to be faculty. They let them become faculty. So they'll work on a step salary and they'll do pretty well with their salaries. But there are some that aren't in that realm. In collegiate athletic trainers, I was talking recently to a former athletic trainer. She's since retired. She went into the state police academy, became a state trooper, and then became their athletic trainer for the academy. And she said, you know, when she worked at Harvard University back in the early to mid-90s, and that's where I met her. And she had said, you know, her salary then was $65,000 a year. She goes, 25 years later, the salary is the exact same at Harvard University. And she's like, they made the 10-month position, a 12-month position. She's like, so who's taking that position? I get it. You're working for Harvard University and it's a prestigious, you know, institution. But don't you think the salary for the athletic trainer should have increased over that 25 years by X percentage year over year with the amount of money Harvard makes as a business? So it is quite interesting. It'd be interesting to see kind of where that goes. But as we try to develop and advocate for ourselves, how do you think we get there? Like, who is the one that's driving it?
Well, we are. We're the ones that are driving it. And we keep making the same mistakes all over again. So, you know, we're not driving our salary because we can't point out what our value. We do a very poor job as a profession in documentation. Mm-hmm. When I ran a clinical operation in Maryland for almost 20 years, I was horrified to see the amount of documentation that was going on, both amongst my physical therapists and our athletic trainers. And I'm not saying that, you know, you got to sit down there and write an epistle for every patient that you see, but you need to have certain documentation if you're going to get paid for it, especially in third-party reimbursement. Mm-hmm. The issue that we have done is that we haven't proclaimed what our worth is. Mm-hmm. We don't really know how to tell people how much we're worth. So we're willing to take the same jobs over and over again. And I'm just as guilty as anybody else. You know, I used to have athletic trainer interns that would come to me with a bachelor's degree that were wanting to get their foot in the door in college athletics, and I would hire them for $10,000 a year for 10 months. Mm-hmm. Was that good or bad? I don't know. Most of those people have gone on to successful careers. Most of them are still in the athletic training profession. Some have left out, gone into nursing and so forth. Mm-hmm. But I think that the question becomes is, are we advancing our own profession? And has the NATA embraced that in a dollars and cents perspective? And that's where I feel like we've dropped the ball. We, as athletic trainers, me too, and the profession and the association, the NATA, I think has been schizophrenic over its last 25 years. It failed to embrace the move out of the traditional setting, made some critical mistakes about that. We've now allowed all these ancillary types of programs to develop without really any kind of coordination with the NATA. And so we've abdicated a lot of those skills and responsibilities and ownership and the recognition of the profession to other organizations. I'll give you another perfect example. Do you feel that the NATA has really done a great job at advancing the profession into the secondary school level? Or do you think the Corey Stringer Institute has done a better job?
That's a great question. I mean, Corey Stringer, I've done some stuff with them. So I think they've done an unbelievable job. I mean, that's what made us write the position statement for us to do, you know, proper care of heat illness, you know, and heat stroke was because of Corey Stringer.
If you talk to the majority of high school athletic trainers across the country,
and
you ask them, what's the biggest driver and influence to advocate for your profession as a secondary school athletic trainer? They'll probably say Corey Institute. Mm-hmm. Doug Cosby.
Yeah, Doug's done an amazing job.
You know, but what has the NATA done?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you might find some little obscure column in the NATA news on a monthly basis that you might be able to read 3-4 months later, but the advancement of the profession, I think, has really been stalled because of our own problems. And we have not been able to focus it in one direction, which is to advance the profession and increase our pay and our value at the same time. Now, we talk about it a lot, but we haven't really done
it. We've moved on it. Yeah, I agree. I think there's a lot to be said for, you know, the organization wanting to reach the members and provide for the members. We talk about advocacy and we talk about, you know, proper care for athletes. And it starts at even the youth level on how to properly care for them and make sure they're healthy. But if you want to put someone that's educated in a position that can provide great care and provide great service to those athletes, you have to advocate for that. And you talked about documentation, and I'll go back to that because when I was finishing my senior year at Northeastern, my last internship was at Harvard. Dick Emerson was my clinical supervisor. And MO said to me, he's like, Andrew, you got to take good documentation. This is going to help you provide the information that you need for advocating for yourself for salary increase and to justify your position, but also to just cover your butt if somebody gets injured and decides that you didn't do the right thing for them. And all of a sudden you end up in court, right? So, and Chad pushed that in our organ ad class. Like I think Peg Stacy was our teacher then. I don't know if you know Peg, but she's the one who did that for us. But as I continue to move forward, I always was very good with documentation because we used an EMR. I used it from day one. And I use Sportswear, which is out of Boston, CSMI Solutions. And I still use them today, and they keep evolving. And I always tell my students, be as good as you can with the documentation, and that's going to give you the ability to be able to advocate for yourself. And I can pull up and bring to my administration how many evaluations I did this year, how many treatments I did this year, what the rate of return was, what the plan of care is off for every athlete. And at least that gives them an understanding of like, hey, what's being provided. And you said it. I mean, when we started, our documentation was horrible. It was all handwritten when we were in school. People couldn't read it. We were really doing the right thing, you know, and it has evolved. But I do feel that the organization needs to do a little bit more for the secondary school, because that's where it is. We have over 600 high schools in Massachusetts that could use athletic trainers. And I don't know the percentage that are in schools, but it's definitely not 600 athletic trainers. I can tell you that. And that's because of funding. And it's also because of our governing body, the MIAA, doesn't push the envelope as far as, you know, every school needs an athletic trainer. And there's enough athletic trainers out there to employ them, but also the salaries need to be there. So a lot of work to do.
Well, you know, a lot of people, especially here from a lot of secondary schools, and from some other people in our profession, that, you know, we need to be in a union, and then the union is going to advance the profession and get better salaries. I'm not sure if that's the correct pathway to take, but I do feel like we don't do a very good job advocating for ourselves personally. And a lot of times, you know, you're meeting with your principal or your athletic director at the collegiate setting. We talk about is, you know, we're working too many hours, but yet we don't stand there and say, look how many athletes I treated. This is the documentation that I have. This is the number of our, we don't do that. We'll sit there and complain about it.
Yeah.
So it's very difficult for you to move the process forward if you don't have documentation to back yourself up. And the other thing that I think that we have to question is this whole issue of third-party reimbursement. Is that right? Something that we need to be chasing in order for us to make the profession better? I don't proclaim to have the answer for that. I think third-party reimbursement is a horrible game. I dealt with it for almost 20 years in Maryland when I ran our clinic. It's brutal. I mean, and if you look at what's going on with healthcare today and what the insurance companies will deny, and how do you get patients to pay for things on their own, get self-pay involved in it, and collection of deductibles and co-pays and stuff like that. Is that a kind of business that you want to spend your time chasing the dollar around rather than being involved with patient care?
We've talked about third-party reimbursement since I got out of college. It's been a long time, right? And, you know, despite the discussions of it and the athlete training service remaining inconsistent across the United States, you know, states like Virginia, Connecticut, Wisconsin, and maybe another one in there, they've made strides in gaining third-party reimbursement in certain settings, but there's challenges due to regulatory, legislative, and insurance barriers. And I feel like there's always that kind of, you know, thought process, can we do this? Can we get it to happen? And I see it in the private practice where you're dealing with co-pays, deductibles, high deductibles of that matter. When, you know, 30 years ago, you would have a patient come in and their bill, their co-pay was $5 or $10, and you were getting reimbursed $100 for every visit. Now the patient has a $25, $30, $40, $50 co-pay, a $3,000 deductible, and the insurance company's paying $105 reimbursement or whatever it is, right? So it's not much better. Overcoming the hurdles and, you know, it's concentrated in the professional organization and policymakers, do you think that we can get to a model of third party, or you feel like they've kind of turned a cheek to it because it's an uphill battle? And, you know, quite frankly, Medicare is cutting another 3%. So I think it's 15% down. I mean, it's not great, right? So, and they drive everything. So where do you think we are in that process?
Well, we failed miserably for the last 25 years to get Medicare recognition. Mm-hmm. So until we can do that, most of the other payers are not going to pay us. They've been successful in those states that you mentioned, as well as a little bit in Georgia. So if an athletic trainer is going to submit for reimbursement there, the insurance companies now by law have to pay that athletic trainer whatever they're going to pay another private practitioner, whether it be a chiropractor or a physical therapist, et cetera. So there's no discrimination between the professions. In Michigan, they've also done a pretty good job in a limited setting up there. But those are the only states that have been able to do that. And the reason they did that was they had people locally at the state level that were driving the process that got more involved. So you've got 50 states right now that have some form of regulation. California has registry. But up until last year, the state of South Carolina only had certification. So, you know, you have certification in one state, and you have licensure in another state, you have registry in another state. Everybody has a different state practice act. And whether or not those practice acts will help you or hinder you in terms of third-party reimbursement, and the fact that we don't do a very good job with documentation, so that our new grads coming out are not doing as good a job as they need to do in terms of documentation. I think third-party reimbursement is like chasing a shadow. It's just never, you're never going to be able to get to that point where it becomes economically feasible for all of us to be able to participate in the third-party reimbursement world. And it's a nasty world. You know that.
Yeah.
You've been in the clinical setting for a long time, you know?
Yeah. And do you think that, you know, working in professional sports, you know, you did for some years, did workman's comp ever, is that part of the like algorithm or no? I know some of them may do it now. I'm not 100% sure. I have some friends that are in pro sports. I really haven't talked to them about that.
Yeah, we when I was in Florida with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, you know, we had to deal with workers' compensation. A lot of owners would prefer not to submit to workers' compensation, and they'll just self-pay the bills themselves.
Yeah.
The same thing happened in the state of Maryland. Maryland had a workers' compensation law that excluded professional athletes if they got hurt while they were playing. So if someone was running down the field at Memorial Stadium on Sunday afternoon and blew out their knee, that's not covered by state workers' compensation in that law. But if the light pole fell down, hit him in the head, broke their neck, gave him a concussion, that was covered.
Interesting.
So if you really want to scare the hell out of yourself, what's going to happen in the collegiate setting?
With the NIL stuff?
If the NCAA says all collegiate athletes are employees.
Right.
And now you have to be an employee at Harvard or at University of South Carolina or at Clemson or at Alabama or at UCLA. So now all those athlete trainers are going to have to deal with worker compensation laws in every one of those different states. Oh, my goodness. Talk about a mess.
Yeah. And I, you know, I wonder how much the treating across state lines runs into this whole process, too. And I haven't talked to friends about this, but if you're going from one state to the other and you're working in a location for several days, how does that, you know, translate? And if you were reimbursing, how does that work? Can you reimburse in that state versus, you know, so I think it is pretty interesting. And if it even is going to happen, it would be a probably a very big challenge.
Well, the legislation that was passed a few years ago allows you to cross into different states. So you could go into Connecticut or Vermont or New York if you're traveling with your team and treat your team while you're traveling with them, but only them.
Mm-hmm.
The question then becomes is, you know, when you're crossing state lines, let's say you're going to move from your job with ATI in Massachusetts and you want to move to ATI here in Greenville, South Carolina.
Yeah.
We have a big practice with the Stedman Hawkins Orthopedic Group.
Yeah.
So now, is there going to be reciprocity that covers that? And in a lot of states, there's no reciprocity in athletic training. There is in physical therapy. But in our case, so do we need to be a part of the U.S. government compact that's right. now looking at allowing you to move from one state to another state? That's particularly impactful in the military because so many of these athletic trainers have jobs that may move them with a large corporation from South Carolina to Georgia to North Carolina to California. So there's a lot of things that we need to look at in that respect. Not to mention the fact that, you know, if everybody has a different state, you can move into that state and you may find yourself paralyzed for 6 months to maybe a year before you're able to get your documentation together and move everything through the process because some of those state boards move very slowly. And so then you can't practice.
Right.
You know, I remember an athletic trainer getting paralyzed in Ohio and she was there for 9 months.
Mm.
She finally got her license and able to practice. She didn't get paid.
Yeah.
She was in there not getting paid.
Yeah.
She had a job, but she couldn't get paid.
I know some of the stuff we run into with our state board is when things get hung up, it's either a transcript that doesn't get delivered or the background check is slow. And that is just frustrates people. And I feel like in this day and age, it should be instantaneous. It's almost like you should have a bare bones license that transfers like a driver's license until everything checks out. Right. So that's where the compact comes in. So I'm hoping that that's something that is moving into the future. But moving on to like, you know, the competitive job market, I think the athletic trainers or athletic trainers in general are encouraged to diversify their skills and their knowledge. That's why a lot are getting multiple degrees or trying to move into other sectors of healthcare to try to market themselves a little more. Being multifaceted and possessing, or being experts in multiple disciplines can enhance their employment as an AT. Like with me, I was an athletic trainer by trade and still am, and I still declare myself as an athletic trainer, but I went back and ended up getting my PTA degree 12, maybe 15 years ago. My former employer said, hey, I think this is great for you. I want you to run a clinic. This is what I want you to do. You've been working with me for, you know, 15 years at the time. And that's why I ended up doing it, even though I had a really good job in the high school setting. Do you think that, you know, the hyper-focus or advanced certifications are not working well for the athletic trainer? Do you think they are? Do you think that's where we need to go to be more marketable? Where are your thoughts on that?
Well, there's been a lot of discussion about that recently also on LinkedIn. There's been a lot of controversy as to, you know, salary discrepancies and how is the advanced degree helping us in terms of our earnings. And I'm not sure, you know, that in some respects that, you know, we have not been the victim of a brain drain because we've seen so many people leave the profession, go back to PA school, go to nurse practitioner school, go back to physical therapy school, get that other degree. And so they still have their ATC credential, But in actuality, they're not practicing as an athletic trainer anymore. They've done that because of the salaries and, and the cost of living and how they have to struggle in terms of the hours and quality of life. So I don't know that, you know, getting advanced certifications in many respects does an awful lot for you financially. It may do things more effectively for you clinically. So like, for instance, going to take a course in dry needling, an advanced course in modalities. Those are things that, yeah, from a professional standpoint, they're good to have. They make you a better clinician, but it's not going to put any money in your pocket. And I think we as a profession right now, I see it happening more in the collegiate setting and in some clinical settings, probably spend an inordinate amount of time on doing those advanced specializations rather than documentation and moving into what our strength should be, which is rehabilitation, reconditioning, and return to play. So what's happened, it's opened a little window for the, quote, sports scientists, the people that are in the reconditioning business. And you've seen the salaries for strength coaches and sports scientists types of people accelerate way,
way up.
I mean, when you got a strength coach at the collegiate setting is making close to $1 million a year, and the entry-level athletic trainer is coming in at $32,000 a year, and they're working 100 hours a week. That strength coach has got assistants that are starting at $75,000 and $80,000. They all have the same degree. They may not be any further than a master's level. So what's happened? You know, where did we make the mistake right there? The other problem is we don't toot our own horns. We don't do that. And one of the reasons why we don't do a very good job of that is because we don't document very well. So we can't go back to our athletic director and say, look at my documentation. And I'm not talking about writing a SOAP note for a particular athlete. I'm talking about how many people came in, how much time per person, how many modalities did it, how many rehabs did they get? And those information pieces often get missed and they don't get advanced out to the people that make the decisions.
I have to agree. I feel like the money that strength conditioning coaches make is, I feel like, is absurd compared to the education that we have to go through and the amount of knowledge that we have and what we provide to keep them healthy. It is very interesting, but I think the bigger, stronger, faster athlete makes the organization money, and they don't see the healthcare piece as a big, for lack of a better word, a positive, you know, influence, I guess, on the athlete. And again, it falls back on us. We've been talking about it for years. I feel like we need to do more. We need to do better. Some people may disagree with us talking today about this, but I feel like there's, you know, we've lived it and we've been in it. You know, I think I've done really well. And I think it's because I've, you know, worked with a lot of individuals. I've worked and marketed myself in the way that I provide what I think is, you know, great care for the people I take care of. And that's been good for me. And I've stayed, like I said, I'm still practice as an athletic trainer every day. And that's what I do. And I still practice in a clinical setting outside of the athletic training. So I'm still kind of, I work a lot of hours, but that's my choice and that's what I do. But, you know, I think we definitely have a lot of work to do as a profession to make people understand what we do. I think there's still people that don't know what we do. I remember Chad telling us one day, he goes, you know, go into a grocery store and walk through and just, if someone asks you what you do, tell them you're an athletic trainer. And they'll say, do you train horses? Do you train? Like, they won't know what you do. And that is still the fact today. Like, people do not know what we do. And I think unless they've been an athlete and had a experience with a relationship with an athletic trainer, nobody knows what we do. And that's where that discussion had come around since when I've started. Should we have been sports therapists, sports medicine, athletic therapists? Like, where does that, you know, come into the conversation? But I still think athletic training is like, you need to educate what it is. It's not about the name. It's about the education of what you do. So, you know, going in, you know, kind of moving along into like statistical concerns and things that we're seeing and at the levels that we're seeing where athletic trainers are actually working. In the previous, this 2024 December newsletter from the AAT, now I think it's still a little clouded because you had alluded to earlier, there's, you know, maybe 30 some odd or a little under 30,000 members in the NATA. How many athletic trainers are not in the NATA? So say there's 50 or 60,000 athletic trainers in the country. These statistics are a little skewed. So, you know, in the amateur sports and youth sports, there's 0.4% like athletic trainers in that profession or working in that level. Secondary school, about 22 or 23%. College, 25%. Professional level is about 3.5%. And I think that's kind of low, but I'm not certain. I guess if you look at the diversity or the size of professional sports versus secondary and collegiate, it would make sense. While the statistics do demonstrate a large saturation in college and secondary schools, given the membership of the NATA, do you feel like there's an increase or a need in the youth and amateur levels? And if so, how do we get there? And is it something we need to address in the national level, the state level, or both levels? Where do you think we're at there?
Well, I think, first of all, it's absolutely horrible You know, I've got a grandson who's getting ready to turn six, and my daughter's talking to me about putting him in T-ball. And I'm like, absolutely don't do that. There's nobody there knows what's going on. All you're going to do is get a bunch of dads going to start screaming and hollering at him. You're going to get upset. My son-in-law's going to get upset. My grandson's going to probably get upset and maybe quit the sport. So let's don't do that. Mm-hmm. So the reality of the situation is that that's a field that I don't think anybody can get. You talk about the NCAA and collegiate athletics being chaotic and, you know, what up – This area here is completely controlled by the entrepreneur coaches, wannabe coach dads that want to have these advanced academies, these travel teams, these clubs, the kids that are playing essentially 9, 10, 11, 12 months a year. They go to the big tournaments. They're going to all these big jamborees where, I mean, there's thousands of kids there. Parents are all over the place. It's costing them thousands and thousands of dollars. You know, I worked for 30 some odd years in the state of Maryland, which is lacrosse crazy.
Yeah.
So you know, on the weekend, you know, you get a lacrosse tournament going on. You just can't imagine how many people will show up at those things and the cost for them to enter that. Well, where's all that money going? Mm-hmm. Well, if I was doing PRN work covering a big lacrosse tournament, the guy who was running it would say to me, I only want one athlete trainer. Oh, by the way, you have 8 fields going on, 8 games all at one time.
Yeah.
And by the way, you need to tape everybody if they come in here. Oh, bring your own supplies. And oh, by the way, I'm only going to pay you $150 for the day.
Yeah. And somebody will take it.
I would say, no, I'm not doing that. Yeah. I'm not bringing my own tape. I'm not going to work there all day by myself. Yeah. I can't watch 8 fields by myself. And I'm not going to. And so we've got to learn that whole field there where we absolutely need the most help, that's not going to be penetrable. Right. Unless you come up with a business model. Or an organization can crack that code and be able to go in there. Now, can we do a better job at the high school level and the collegiate level? Absolutely. Again, we need to make sure that we're in the landscape where we can continue to flourish, advance the profession. I think there's a big, big need in the youth sports level. But according to what's going on right now in our economy, that's not going to happen right now. Parents pay, you know, $1,000 to $2,000 for them to enter their son or daughter into a program. But they're not going to pay, you know, $50 an hour for an athletic trainer to come in and do PRN work.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because I had this conversation with my athletic director, you know, last year. And, you know, they've been pretty good with PRN stuff when I have, you know, a conflict or I need someone to come in if I'm at a conference. I said, listen, you're paying referees $125 to come and ref a game for what? Like, they're coming to walk around with a whistle in their mouth and two of them at that. So you're paying $250 and you're paying an athletic trainer $40 an hour. I said, we're going to start paying $55 to $60 an hour. You're not going to get someone in here to cover. And the parents are going to be pissed because I have the right to be able to go to a conference. And if I have a conflict, you're supposed to have somebody here to be able to help cover that event. And right. It isn't fair to the athlete, really. I mean, we've been able to do that across our district where that's kind of been the going rate because people won't take the jobs anymore. They're like, nope, not available. And I understand that 100%.
Well, that's the good thing that we've been able to change the paradigm over the last few years is to say no to the bad jobs. I've been trying to tell young athletic trainers that for years. I'm guilty of it. I did it myself, you know, but I got in a lot of arguments with coaches and meet directors and tournament directors saying, you know, we're not doing that. You know, we're not going to cover that. Yep. You're not paying. If I go to a large wrestling tournament and I'm the only athletic trainer there, you got probably 10, 12 wrestling referees that are there and they're switching off every match. I don't ever get a switch off. I mean, I may not even have time to go to the bathroom.
Right, right.
Or get a hot dog or something, So there's just a lot of things. And we've got to keep telling our young students about those things. And at the same time, we need to go back and tell those people that run those tournaments, you can't keep doing it that
right,
way.
Right, right. My hope is that it's moving there with some of the organizations that are running some of the PRN stuff for us. Mass General Brigham is one of them. They employ a lot of athletic trainers. So I think they're starting to get that understanding and the pay that those athletic trainers deserve. So I'm hoping, like for me, I know that that's what they're getting in my level. So I'm hoping that it just keeps translating. And the youth sports are a big one. Like, I feel like that needs to be, you know, they're like, well, we only have 5 fields going. How many injuries? And I think if you threw a statistic at them, the amount of injuries that can happen per 1,000, it would probably raise an eyebrow. But none of us, I think, not that we're not smart enough, is we don't have it at our fingertips saying, hey, this is what the risk versus reward is. Like, hey, it's an insurance policy to make sure people are healthy and they get what they need. So.
Well, it's hard to track because, you know, that kid will go from field 1 to field 5 to field 8, and then they're gone. And then they're going to play in another tournament on the same weekend or in the same day. You know, I remember talking to a high school athletic director back in Baltimore County, and he said, come in here. I want you to take a look at this little girl. She's a soccer player. She got hurt Friday night. She was a sophomore. She was starting on the varsity. She got hurt in the game Friday night. He took her out. She had a badly sprained ankle. I saw her on Monday. The thing was like the size of an elephant's foot. Yeah. And I'm like, my God, how did you do this? And so she says, well, you know, I got hurt Friday night. And then on Saturday we had a tournament. And then, you know, I said, well, did you play on Saturday? Oh, yeah. Well, how'd you play? Well, my father and my coach taped me up. I said, and how did you play in that game? She said, well, I played 8 games on Saturday.
That's ridiculous. Like,
yeah. You know, well, she couldn't even walk when I saw her. Yeah. So that's the kind of insanity that, you have to deal with. And I don't know how to answer the question of youth sports. I think that might be a lost cause. And I don't know whether that will ever be a solution to that whole landscape there.
Yeah. So the future of athletic training is, I feel like it's hanging in a balance somewhat. Like, we talk about this quite frequently. If we want to see the profession continue to grow and need to continue to adapt and innovate, we as a profession need to do that. As healthcare landscape changes, athletic trainers, I believe, still need to advocate for themselves in the role of sports medicine and injury prevention. And that goes back to our documentation discussion and not taking those low-paying jobs. Do you feel that there is a single most important thing, or a thing that's more important as a group, to continue to see the growth and development of the profession and its members?
Well, I'm not so sure that we've taken advantage of our allies. And by that, I mean, you know, the medical field. So our docs, team docs, people that are athletically inclined, whether it be pediatrician and orthopedic surgeon, radiologist, you know, those people need to come with us to the meetings, to talk to parents, to talk to school boards, talk to collegiate administrators, high school administrators, to talk about the value and also about the healthcare. Because what we don't do is we don't proclaim what our value is in terms of cost savings. So if you're sitting at your high school in Massachusetts, you're saving your school a ton of money. So mm-hmm. you've got to go document to your athletic director, your principal, your superintendent, how much money you're saving them. And ultimately, it comes down to the cost of doing business in there. Likewise, those athletic trainers that are working in large clinical settings, they've got to go up to their hospital administrators and they've got to document what are the revenue streams they're bringing in. So we don't track downstream revenue. Mm-hmm. So every time you refer somebody, they come in, they get an emergency room visit, they go to urgent care, they get an x-ray, they get an MRI, they see an orthopedic surgeon, they get an arthroscopy, they get the physical therapy. We're not documenting that. So we have got to do a better job of advancing our profession at that pace, because it's moving so quickly. We say, well, I'm too busy, I don't have time to do that. Well, you're going to have to do that. And we're not doing a very good job of teaching our young students about that documentation. On the other hand, we're doing a great job of telling them they've got to get more advanced degrees. They've got to learn how to do suturing. They got to learn how to run an IV. They got to learn how to do a lot of different things that, as they come out as an entry-level grad. But yet, how do you end up paying for all that stuff? And like right. you said, if you're coming out of there paying $50,000 a year for 3 years to get a master's degree right now, most people are going to say, oh, I'll take that job for the first year. But after that, I'm sitting on $140,000, $50,000 worth of student debt. I'm out of here. Yeah. I'll go to something else. Mm-hmm. So we as a profession and as an association need to do a better job of pulling in all the components so that the educators and the people in the BOC and the NATA and get all our state presidents together and bring the whole thing together so it's a consensus and we move the process forward. I just think that we've lost it. We've become helter-skelter all over the place. We've got too many different things going on. I think sometimes if you look at the NATA news, if you look at their social media postings, you know, do I go to Twitter? Do I go to Instagram? Do I go to Facebook? Do I go to LinkedIn? And there's all kinds of different things being released at different times and different platforms. And a lot of times we don't have time to look at it. So by the time you pick it up and you look at it, it's like, well, that was 2 months ago. God,
right,
God.
Right. So
where have we made the mistake? You know, and I think a part of it has to be the fact is that we've made a lot of mistakes. And the NATA can't solely take the blame on it. I think our educators have to take part of that blame as well. But definitely, we need to look at the specializations as we're developing those. And our profession is so diverse right now, we've got to pull everybody back together, because right now you've got separate societies that are advancing their profession in that one little direction right now.
Right. No, I agree 100%. I feel like you made a great point about the revenue stream. I never even thought about that. You know, where's the downhill revenue? Where's that going? How's that helping? And we talk about, you know, the savings and cost savings of healthcare and how that helps. And I think the biggest advocate for the athletic trainer, especially in the secondary school systems, is the parents, right? If you did well for an athlete, they will go out of their way to make sure that you're recognized. And I think that's important. So if you can have them advocate for you, for coaches to advocate for you, I think that's going to help, you know, some of those younger athletic trainers that are struggling in those spaces to gain more recognition, notoriety, salary increases, you know, because of cost of living and to make it worth their while. Because like you said, you know, and I've seen it, I've had classmates that left and went into other professions because of it. They went back to business. They went to nursing. They went to PA school, whatever it may be. They went to PT school. I think that's because of the frustration of the salaries and banging their heads against the wall. But, you know, like you said, I think the hope is that we start to see more, you know, kind of coming back to the roots of athletic training and really building your brand, what you need to do to become more, I think, critical in the workforce that you're in and how you're dealing with the athletes that you're dealing with. You know, for graduates that are coming out or new grads, I think seasoned professionals as well, I feel like networking and involvement in the professional organizations, if it's the NATA, if it's other avenues, I think is very important. I think for the growth and development and opportunities that lie ahead of us. So with seasoned professionals and mentorship and young colleagues and engaging in the lifelong learning experience, I feel like that's a very influential piece. And we talked a little bit about it before. And I think that's what's going to keep our profession, you know, moving forward is that mentorship, that networking, our ability to meet people at certain levels of, if it's conference, if it's organizational meetings, if we continue to do those things. What advice would you give professionals beginning a career after the things that you did coming up into the profession?
Well, first of all, you have to find your passion. So if you're really passionate about it, that's going to set you on a successful career path. You've got to develop stronger relationships with your mentors. Mentorship is so important in our profession. You know, at one time you can say athletic trainers could communicate news faster than the internet, the telegraph, the television, yep, the cell phone. You know, you could pick up the phone, call Chad Starkey and about 15 other people, and that news would spread across the country just that fast before, yep, you know, you have time to pick up your phone and look at it. I think you need to cultivate those professional relationships and friendships and understand that people are going through the same things that you are and have a little bit of compassion about that. So at the same time, you got to emphasize your family. Mm-hmm. You can't spend all the time thinking about somebody else. And I think we've been guilty of that. And we neglected families. I know I did. I neglected my wife and my daughter a lot. Thank God my wife was supportive of me and was able to do that. If I were married to somebody else, I'd probably been divorced 4 times by now. I think we've missed some grand opportunities to take advantage of some of our historical marketing partners. So stop and think about this. So we had Gatorade and we had Johnson & Johnson as two huge corporate sponsors for the profession and for the NATA. Mm-hmm. Suppose every time your wife went to the drugstore to buy a box of Band-Aids or a bottle of Tylenol or Gatorade for your daughter, and there was a little logo on this bottom with the NATA logo, and it says, does your child or grandchild have a certified licensed athletic trainer? We missed that. Mm-hmm. We missed that for 25, 30, 40 years. We didn't take advantage of that marketing opportunity. So we've made some big mistakes along the line. What we need to do is go back and reflect on where are those mistakes, you know, whether it was marketing, whether it was specialty certification, whether it was educational reform. Has that hurt us? Has that helped? And we need to go back and reanalyze that thing. Now, some people say, well, that's what our NATA board is doing on a regular basis. But at the same time, it's not working very well. Mm-hmm. So now you got to scratch your head and say, okay, what are we doing right? What are we doing wrong? Most importantly, what I would say to a very young athletic trainer, stay off your damn phone.
Yeah.
There's nothing more revolting to see you covering a game or at a practice and you're over there, you're looking at your phone at Instagram, texting somebody, or you're talking on the phone because somebody's watching you, whether yeah, it's a coach, an administrator, a parent, and God forbid you're on the phone talking while some kid has a catastrophic injury or exertional heat illness and you're too busy on your phone and you don't see what's going on.
Right. You miss it.
Stay off your phone. Find your passion. Cultivate your mentors. Emphasize your family.
Yep. I think that was well said and well taken. I find that how we all ended up where we are today, I think, is through a lot of those things you had mentioned. And I think mentorship being one of the biggest ones. And I feel like for us, when I started, my first team physician was with me for a few years. I started out in a college setting, and the team physician that I had was at Children's Hospital Boston. He still works there today. I still have a great relationship with him. I refer him patients all the time. They get them in very quickly for us. My second team physician that I had still works with me, still covers football with me. He was the head team physician for the Patriots, for the Red Sox, for the Bruins, and still covered football with me, which was out of control. Like, I'm like, what are you doing coming to high school football? And because he lived in the town, he loved it. He loved just bringing his kids. They could stand on the sideline with him. And I end up getting to meet and work with all of his fellows that came through his practice. And all those fellows became orthopedic surgeons in the region or throughout the country. And I still reach out to all of those and have relationships with them. So that's how we build those relationships and get better, is by seeing and working with the physicians that we're with, asking questions, not being afraid to ask questions. And again, not being on your phone, because we talk about this where you're like a, I say you're like a Disney character on stage. Like, if I can hear you and see you, everybody else can. And God forbid, if an athlete is playing in front of you and they go down with an injury and you don't catch how the mechanism was, that could change the way that your assessment is, right? So you're probably going to get to the right assessment, but you could at least catch something when it's happening. And we're not all like great at seeing things happen because there's a lot of stuff going on at one time. But again, be focused and be doing what you should be doing, which is working.
When I was working in the NFL, the majority of the time I watched the game, I'm on the opposite side from where everybody else is standing. So if the offense is over here, everybody's standing on that side of the 50-yard line, mm-hmm. I'm on the other side. So I have a clearer view. And also I'm squatting down because I'm watching the game from the waist down.
Yeah.
I'm not watching who's throwing the long pass and catching the ball. Yeah, I'll do that if that happens. But most of the time, our injuries are going to occur between the offensive and defensive linemen,
right,
or somebody who's getting smacked up in the middle like that. So I watched the game from a different perspective when I was in the NFL, and I still do that today. A lot of times when I'm watching stuff on TV, I'm not watching what's happening, who's throwing the ball and stuff like that. I'm watching
The ground.
Yeah. So I think a lot of those things we don't teach very much anymore.
Right.
And I think, again, it goes back to the mentorship. You know, what drives the profession? It's learning from somebody who's been there, who's done that, who's made those mistakes and says, be careful because this is going to end up happening to you. Mm-hmm. And I can't begin to tell you how many times people have called me back over the years and said, you know what? Remember when you told me so-and-so-and-so is going to happen? Guess what? It happened.
It happens.
Yeah.
And that text and that email can wait, by the way.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, I'm trying to tell them that. It's not instant. You don't need to.
Reading them and answering them when you have to do it. But long hours. So
yeah.
Long hours.
One last question for you. What's a fun fact about you or maybe something you love to do in your free time or your retired time, I should say?
I told my daughter about this the other day and she almost died laughing. So I took 40 lessons. So I'm a mixed descent of Cuban, Italian, Cherokee, Indian. I had a little Italian grandmother from Sicily in Tampa in Ybor City. And so she and my mother decided that I needed to learn how to play the accordion. So I had this guy. Italian guy taught me accordion lessons for 10 years. We had a marching accordion band.
Yeah, that's great.
Somebody sent me a picture of that the other day and I almost died laughing. So yeah, that made my Italian nun. I'm very happy.
That's fantastic. And my mother is a Sicilian and my dad said, you know, you can't trust the Sicilian woman. He goes, I think she sleeps with a knife under a pillow. But that's great. I love the accordion thing. I was talking to one of our physicians and I asked him the same question. He's one of our physicians at Children's. And he said, I go, what do you do? Like, what's your downtime with the kids? And he's like, we play marbles. I go, you play marbles? He's like, it's unbelievable. We go to marble tournaments. I'm like, there's marble tournaments. So it's funny with some of the things you hear about, you know, but that's awesome. Listen, I truly appreciate you coming on today. I think the conversation was great. I think it's good for the profession to hear some of these things and hopefully a lot of people tune in, and it was a pleasure having you on here.
Well, I thank you for having me here, and it's good to hear the things that you're doing. I would encourage you to reach out to different states and tap into your network of older athletic trainers and say, who do I need to talk to in Maryland? Who do I need to talk to in Nebraska? Who do I need? There are some great people all over the country. Sometimes I just pick up the phone out of the clear blue sky and call somebody and say, hey, Rizzo, how are you doing? What's going on up in Massachusetts? You know? So.
Right. And that's where I lean on like someone like you now that I have been introduced to by Chad, or I lean on Chad and say, hey, who are some of the older professionals that I can talk to? And then he'll, or to Chris, who's up here in Massachusetts. So if you do have anybody that you know would like to come on and discuss kind of their journey or some things that they want to go over, I'd love to have that opportunity.
Yeah, it's great to have that friendship. Chad and I share a lot of Roadrunner cartoons.
I'm sure. The internet. Some of the stuff that him and I had talked about in our conversation when I was a student, I was like, we were dying laughing just because, you know, they don't escape you. The way he taught us was like this total, you know, stratosphere teaching, you know, moment, but we all remembered it, you know, and that's what we loved about him is he always taught us a way that we would not forget it. So,
well, you don't have to be crazy to work in this profession, but it helps if you.
Yeah, it definitely crazy. Does. Yeah. Well, thanks again, John.
Great. It's good talking to you. And let me know if I can do anything to help you out. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. Follow us on social media and check out our website.
The information shared on this podcast is for educational and informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice. Please consult a licensed healthcare provider for guidance related to your specific situation. We'll see you next week.